Hey everybody, it's John. I wanted to remind you that we do have a Patreon page at patreon.com/alienminute. Over there on Patreon, Mitch and I discuss subjects concerning movies and television and just about anything else we want to talk about. So if you want to come over there, you can subscribe for $2 a month for one episode or $5 a month for every episode at patreon.com/alienminute. Thank you. Hello and welcome back to 007x7, the podcast where we're investigating the James Bond films 7 minutes at a time. I'm John Engel.
And I'm Mitch Bryan. And today, we're looking at minutes 84 to 91, which begin with the mysterious figure's black-gloved hands lifting the covers near Bond's face, and ends with Bond replacing a concealed table knife saying to Dr. No, "We can't all be geniuses, can we?" In between, we watch Honey and Bond change into new clothes, are escorted to an elevator, and emerge into a fantastic villain's lair where they are joined by Dr. No and all go to the table for some dinner, drinks, and verbal sparring. And today we welcome Cynthia Barron, who's professor in the Department of Theater and Film at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. Her most recent book is titled Acting Indie, Industry, Aesthetics, and Performance. And she contributed to the BBC Radio 4 program James Bond, The Last Englishman. And her wonderful essay, Dr. No, Bonding Britishness to Racial Sovereignty, appears in The James Bond Phenomenon, which is a collection of essays edited by Christoph Lindner. Welcome, Cynthia.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, I'm so glad you could join us. I remember reading that article, that essay, and was just really struck by just the level of, I guess, what we'll call Bond scholarship now that has emerged. I mean, you're in the same book with Umberto Eco. That's pretty good.
Yeah, but he's cool and I'm not, so here's the difference.
I don't know whether to ask you how the article came about or how your relationship with James Bond came about. I mean, let's start there. Do you remember, like, your first James Bond movie or how any of this thing came to your attention?
Well, there are different phases. So when I was a little kid, I was certainly aware of Bond. I mean, it's part of popular culture. The 60s jet set world, what adults are doing. I was both intrigued and terrified by and just felt sort of scared and overwhelmed, but I thought they were all cool. The next phase was that, and again, I don't know if I saw films. All I do remember very clearly are the credit sequences, the graphic design, and a lot of the songs, the music, and so forth. And then the next phase was sort of 70s and 80s, where I actually decided that the Bond films were totally uncool, that they were really square, that they were just really old school. They seem to be from a really sort of archaic time, but they just kept going. And then in the 90s, I started studying them. And so now I don't have an opinion. I just find them fascinating for a whole variety of reasons. Cinematically, the relationship to the film business at specific points, of course, their relationship to culture. So I know a lot of folks that you have on the show have favorite films and so forth. So I don't have any favorites at this point. I find them all quite curious and very, very indicative of their particular times. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. And I'm going to play that answer for my daughter because she said to me just last week, what is it with you and these James Bond movies? Like, why do you like James Bond movies that much? Because she hears me, saying what terrible James Bond movies there are, you know, like, how many of them do you really like, Dad? You know, and I was sort of like, well, not that many. So I'm right there with you. There's something fascinating about them. And they they're 60 years old now, for crying out loud. I mean, it's just amazing that we've got this continuity that walks and stumbles alongside film history in places. I you look at some of those, the bad ones, the A View to a Kill, and those films seem to be made in some weird vacuum. They don't look like movies that are being made around at the same time, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's just, I mean, I think it's worth, I mean, they're part of culture. I mean, the only the Godzilla films, you know, outlast them in terms of, you know, franchise length. So I think it's to not think about them is it would be a mistake.
Yeah. I think that's dead right. Here's a great place to just jump into the minutes in terms of that. I want to talk about these black hands that appear. They are not hooks like in the book. There are these black hands, and I'm going to just toss it to you on that one.
Well, I think that when I first started studying this particular film, I think perhaps initially I was going to try to write on every film. But once I realized how much work went into even trying to write about one, I gave up after the first one. So that's, you know, I'm embarrassed to admit that. You guys have persevered where I have given up. But
so was that kind of the genesis of that essay? You were going to like do one on Dr. No, and then maybe you were going to do one on From Russia with Love and just kind
through there? Yeah. But then once I realized that I had to put each one in context, that became, you know, a mission unto itself. But I'm so excited that you assigned me this segment that you did, because I saw things that I had not seen before, and I've watched this film a lot of times. And I'm just going to go ahead and give away what I've been thinking about. And there's a whole lot more, but
okay.
But I that moment where Dr. No comes in and lifts the covers or the sheet and then drops it. Actually, before I say anything, what the heck do you guys make of that moment? I'm really curious, because that's just weird. You know, John, I know that at various times you've talked about, well, what's the narrative purpose of something?
Right.
What are your thoughts on that?
It's tough to say. I mean, I think it's very weird too. I was not able to really parse a meaning out of it. It feels like one of those moments where we just want to see Connery's face. We just want to, you know what I mean? He's covered by the sheet. He uncovers it. There's Connery. He doesn't move at all. So we know he's really out of it. I think it gives it a little bit of a creepy kind of villainous air in that this guy is able to do this and even move the sheet off of him a little bit without stirring him. That's creepy to me. So I don't know though beyond that, because I agree. It's just a weird moment. It's kind of hard to pinpoint any meaning to it. Mitch, do you have anything?
I just think it's a spectacular tease. I think the whole point is just to try to one more time build the menace of Dr. No, who we've only experienced as a disembodied voice, you know, in the spider scene when Dent goes to pick up the spider. And I just think it's the director showing off and just saying, here, let's find one more moment where we can create suspense, we can put the audience ahead of James Bond, we can still conceal the face of Dr. No, who we've been waiting to meet for, you know, an hour and 10 minutes or whatever at this point. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know what he's up to. I don't know why he wants to look at Bond. You know, in the book, he goes in and he looks at Honey. So this is definitely taken from the book. And the figure comes in and looks at both of them, but he pulls the sheet back and reveals Honey's naked body and stares down on it. So I guess they decided not to do that. I don't know why. They've done plenty of other prurient things, but I don't know.
That's right. That is a difference. I've read the book a number of times, but it's been a while, and I didn't remember. I didn't think that the sheet lifting up, you know, incident was related to Bond, but you're right, it's with Honey. So one, there would be the censorship thing. So they would do that. There's something about the way I totally agree with what you guys have just said. I think both of those things are really pertinent, and they're part of the logic. There's something also, I think, about if I were Joseph Wiseman, and I'm portraying Bond. I mean, portraying Dr. No, and I'm trying to, you know, figure out what I'm doing in the scene. I think it might have something to do, and this is, I want to check and see what you think. I'm going to come in, I'm going to see if my new prized possession is, I'm going to check out my new prized possession. I know of Bond, but I don't know what he looks like. He's cost me a lot of money. He's cost me a lot of trouble, so forth and so on. He's a worthy adversary. What does he look like? The way that Joseph Wiseman drops the sheet once he sees that Bond is still sleeping, I feel that there's a bit of disgust in that. Like, oh, you were so stupid. You didn't realize that, you know, you didn't think that I was going to drug you. You just drank that coffee, you fool. I've outplayed you. I think I'm smarter. Yeah, there's something there. I don't know. Or you're just a man or something. There's something that's it's just so weird. It's there's homoerotic stuff going on. It's just
you know. Oh yeah, I think so. I think you're right. It's loaded. It's got all sorts of good stuff chalked into it.
And you've got Sean Connery really tan, lying there with these white / eggshell colored sheets. Anyway, he's just this embodiment of virility.
I was just going to say, I feel like I clumsily answered the question earlier, and as you've been talking, you've been clarifying it for me, my own answer a little bit, in that you asked me specifically about the function of the narrative, and I don't think I answered that correctly. But as you're talking, I'm realizing, wow, we get these peaks and valleys. You get the peaks and valleys in the plot, and you get the peaks and valleys sometimes within the arc, where the character's at the high point and the low point. And I do think that just to clarify what I was trying to say earlier, this is a low point. We're at the Bond's lowest point now, I guess. He's at this most vulnerable, right? So I think what you're saying adds to that point is that he's like a baby almost here in this situation. So, but yeah, all the other things you're saying too kind of add to that, I think. And
I think that this whole 7 minutes is really Bond is at a really low point. Right. He struggles throughout this whole 7 minutes. I mean, even Honey notes that his hands are sweating. And he keeps trying to take control and he fails each time. I mean, this is really Dr. No's moment, and he drives the narrative forward and Bond is just, he's flailing. Poor guy.
Yeah, I think you're right. And when we get to the dinner table, he can't seem to win. Mm-mm. It's pretty great once we get to that conversation. Mm-hmm. From that menacing moment, dark and sinister, you know, we go to this bright array of beautiful clothing in this closet, and Honey steps in with her bare back to us, and her hair is coiffed. I don't know where the hairstylist came from, but she's had her hair done, and then. It's so interesting because she chooses the dress and she steps over to the mirror and is holding the dress up in front of her and is sort of admiring it. And then she catches Bond looking at her and she reacts again, like, don't look at me. You know, like she's done this is sort of similar to when she comes out of the ocean. And it's not like the Honey in the book that invites his gaze all the time. And frankly, she wishes they would have slept together. This Honey is much more reticent. But what's so weird is she turns around and she kind of just adjusts her body, and in the reflection behind her, her backside is revealed. Like it's just this crazy burlesque move, and it seems to me that it's so clearly inviting the audience to just look at her from both sides now that we have the mirror there. And old Bond is like way back in the frame. He's tiny compared to her, reflected in the mirror. And I don't know, there's just back to that sort of prurience of Dr. No. We didn't get that moment where he pulls the blanket or pulls the sheet away from Honey, but it seems like this is a very direct invitation for us to look at her.
Mitch, I think that's a really good insight, because there have been a couple of times that you guys have pointed out in discussing the earlier sequences where there's something that's happened in the book that may be between the characters that actually then gets displaced and made into a relationship between maybe the actor slash character and the audience. And I think that that's one of those instances. And I think that's a really good observation. And it's certainly, you know, carefully choreographed. In addition, I'm so glad you mentioned her hair, because after listening to you guys talk about whether hair was perfectly coiffed or if it was quaffed. Is that the right way to say it?
That's not a
word I say very often.
I don't know.
Anyway, if someone's hair is perfectly done versus their hair is all messed up, you know, just the presence of Bond or the potential presence of Bond makes their hair go wild. Like they've already been in bed with him. I was thinking, I mean, there's something, her hair is so wonderfully done. I thought, wow, I bet one of the sisters, Sister Rose or Sister Lily. Yeah, Sister Lily. I thought, oh, they must have done your hair. How nice. I do want to talk about them too. If I want to make sure we don't forget to talk about them.
Please do. Because one of them is going to be walking into the scene anyway.
But before we get to that, there's something wonderful about, how the costume that she picks out, it's pink and silver and shiny. And she has these blonde curls. She's just this little dumpling. No, dumpling's not quite the right word. What would you call her?
Yeah.
I mean, she's just scrumptious. Delectable, yeah. And, you know, delectable.
We're on the honeymoon still. We're still in the, you know, they're in this weird honeymoon suite, and there's something so romantic about it. And also so they're building the relationship differently. You know, everything step by step by step. They haven't even kissed yet, I don't think. So there's that going on too. They're building this.
Absolutely. Well, that's that. I think in my mind, this first part before they get into Dr. No's lair, I think of this as the sort of the boyfriend girlfriend sequence.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
You know, she's, what happened? Well, you know, well, my dear, blah, 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 blah. Oh,
and I know.
and then she does. Then once they leave the room, then she does say, "Oh, your hands are sweating." He goes, "Well, I'm afraid too." And they're very gentle with each other. I think when he comes in, he helps her button her outfit right over her ample breast. And then I think, doesn't he kiss her on the cheek?
He does. He kisses her on the cheek in these minutes, which is the first, you know, really overt move of affection. I mean, he's you know, held her hand, or he's sort of held her close, or she's come close to him. But yeah, he kisses her reassuringly. And yes, helps adjust her dress, which Peter Hunt makes the point in one of the commentaries that the fact that she wasn't wearing a bra was like a big deal at this point in movies, you know, because I guess we're coming out of that phase of those amazing 50s bras, and there's none of that here. The other thing too, just in that moment, that's really interesting, is that whole thing, regardless of the shot of Bond reflected, it's basically a single of him and then a single of her. And so when he crosses the room to her, and they come together, Young brings them together with that pan, from that point on until they sit at the table, they're in the same shot at all times. So he starts on two singles, he brings them together, and he keeps them together, which again is great for this boyfriend-girlfriend thing that you're talking about.
Yeah, I was going to ask, I mean, is this the moment where he buttons the button and he puts his hand gently on her, kisses her, and reassures her very sweetly? Is this the sweetest Bond of all Bonds. I mean, this is, I can't remember another time in a Bond movie where he was this sweet to somebody, especially a woman, you know, or anyone. But I was like, wow, it's a, he's amazingly gentle in that one little moment and thoughtful. He's like seeing something in her and then trying to reassure her that it's going to be okay. And I can't think, maybe in Casino Royale with, yeah, Eva Green.
Yeah, that's where I jumped to. Maybe
Oh.
on Her Majesty's Secret Service, he's got a
Yeah.
couple of gentle moments with
Yeah, that's
Tracy.
what I would think of too, because those are the women that, of course, you know, are loved and married and then, of course, sacrificed, which I find upsetting, but that's a whole nother topic.
Yeah.
But isn't it weird that like he's so gentle to her and we're, although getting ahead of ourselves by one movie, he never ever treats Tanya with that kind of gentleness in From Russia with
No,
Love. There's
no,
something
no.
about Honey and Bond that's very
Yeah,
special.
he goes from protective and sweet in this movie to cold in the second movie to using women as a human shield immediately in the third movie. You know, it's like a quick change. Wow, you know, they decided
Right.
they figured out, I guess, what they wanted to do with Bond and corrected course, or you know, wrongheadedly corrected course. But I like this Bond. I like the idea that this comes through, and that's one of the reasons I do like Honor Majesty's Secret Service a lot, is that they think through the relationship, not so much they're not the women are the woman in that one is not a cipher,
Right.
and I don't think Honey's a cipher exactly. I think that they miss some opportunities with her, and they don't write her perfectly. But in this moment, yeah, you see she serves a function here, at least in sharing this danger with him, that I think is valuable to the story.
Right.
It is interesting. We want to give Ian Fleming credit wherever we can, and you know, not only does Honey have more agency in the book than in this film, but you think about some of the other women in the Fleming books that absolutely devastate Bond. Tiffany Case and Gala Brand both. He's crazy about them, and they both, you know, Tiffany Case ultimately leaves him, and Gala Brand doesn't even go out with him. She walks away from him at the very end of the book. So it's weird to think that the women in the books have more agency than the women in the movies, but that may be true for a while.
That's not all that unusual. I mean, you know, again, this is sort of a whole separate topic, but that it even happens in adaptations of Shakespeare. So that this is a whole nother another thing. But I really think that Ursula Andress is used effectively throughout the scene, including the latter parts of the scene. We'll get to that. But I think that she's an integral part. Her character and also her performance are integral parts of the encounter, and it's fun to watch.
Well, would you like to speak to one of the sisters at this point?
Yes. Well, I just want to know what you guys make of them. I mean, so is it Sister Lily who comes in? She comes in her little nurse outfit. What do you call that? What is that little outfit?
I think it's like what hairstylists would wear at the time. It
Oh.
didn't. It didn't. Didn't Catherine Deneuve wear something like that in Repulsion when she was doing people's nails? And I think it was a sort of a standard beauty
Oh,
stylist
okay.
thing.
That does make
Well,
sense.
that's. I was going to say it's kind of funny because I believe earlier when we were talking about them, I compared. My point about them was it was just kind of a contrapuntal note, where you have this. You're captured. You're going to the lair of the villain, and the most friendly people greet you there, right? And what's funny now that we're talking about the hairstyle. I think I described it as a somewhat of an Oz-like moment, like they're stepping through into this like fantasy world. And we talked about the movie shifts into fantasy in these last couple of scenes. So all of a sudden now I'm thinking about you guys have me thinking about the makeover sequence in Wizard of Oz. It's like we got the, you know, when the Tin Man's getting his
Yeah,
nails done
yeah.
and stuff, you know, or whatever. So yeah, that could be what they were going for with the costuming here. I didn't think about that. I don't know if it's directly in line with the Wizard of Oz. It's kind of hard not to draw comparisons to the Wizard of Oz sometimes. It's like a lot of movies seem to make draw comparisons, but yeah, that's interesting if it's true.
But there's certainly, in terms of the costuming for a performance, or the behind the scenes preparation for a performance, that's certainly a lot of what's going on here. And that it is all kind of fantasy. And I even want to talk about this when we talk about the scene at the dinner table, because it seems, particularly with Connery, it seems that he's performing performance. And I'm just really curious what you guys think about that. But I'm so glad, Mitch, that you mentioned that that's the outfit of someone who is in the sort of hair and makeup service industry, that she's there to help them prepare for their meeting with Dr. No. And then I think this even fits in with Bond's comment. And she, you know, he asks if they're properly dressed, or, and she says that they're properly dressed. And then he says, for what? Do you guys, I don't remember the dialogue.
She says, we can't keep the doctor waiting. And he says, oh no, we can't, or something like that. So there's this false,
we can't have that.
Yeah. There's this false politeness all the way through that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Bond seems to be kind of just trying to take the Mickey out of the whole thing.
So we've already kind of talked about them going into the hallway.
Oh yeah, but I want to mention one thing before they leave the room. This is something that, like you know, you always see new things when you go look at these chunks. And Connery, he kind of trips on the rug.
But really?
But he recovers beautifully. But if you watch, yeah, one step just barely catches on the rug, and he kind of lifts his foot up. And I was like, wow, that guy's good.
I'm going to have to go back and watch this again now. Is it on the way to the door?
Yeah, it's on the way to the door.
Okay.
Well, yeah, but what you don't know, Mitch, is that was the best take. Like, he actually fell multiple times in other takes. So
such a klutz.
Boy, that was the best one.
I do like his I like his costume, the sort of reddish brown Nehru jacket, loose fitting, looks very nice with his skin color and his hair color and his eyebrows. The slacks are loose, but, you know, sharp.
Plays nicely with all the bronze in the set.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And then it sets him up to be a contrast to Dr. No. I like the costumes in these films. I suppose that sounds really superficial, but it's also color coded. It's like a moving graphic novel.
I'm really glad we've moved away from the blue shirt and pants into earth tones and industrial tones. I think that's much more pleasing to me.
Well, it fits the setting, right? He was sky blue, ocean blue before, and now we're deep underground. So I think that there's something to be said about that too. And certainly, there's certainly something very earthy about Dr. No's lair. Lots of wood, there's a lot of wood underneath, hundreds of feet under the water, or whatever they say. It's a beautiful set design though, for sure.
You know, when they're walking through that hallway that we've seen before that has that forced perspective all the way back down towards the end, which sells it pretty nicely. That seems to be a big space. That's when he says, or she says, that your hands are sweating. There's no reason for us to not believe that. Like, James Bond is, he's actually scared. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
They remind me of teenagers, you know, and they're playing at being adults. They're both really intimate. And so she can actually be comfortable enough to say, oh, your hands are sweaty. And he says that my hands are sweaty too. But then also then he says, let me do the talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know.
Yeah, let me do the, you know, and it's just, and she's like, okay, you know, and
well, see, in his mind, that's reassuring, you know, in the mind of a man in 1962, that's reassuring. Like, don't worry, honey, you won't have to do any of the talking.
Well, right. But way he really lays it on, which makes it feel like it's a performance of a performance, you know, so, which I think this is not a criticism at all. I think that there's a depth to the choice that is made either directorially in collaboration with Connery, but I think that it's an overcorrection, and it makes me grin.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and what's equally interesting is, as then after he said, "Let me do all the talking," they walk into the elevator, and it's completely silent. They say nothing. They say nothing to each other. It's just like the previous passage through the first corridor where they come in and it's got all that weird pink light and everything, and it's this mm-hmm. transitional moment. And again, they don't say anything there either. So this scene is played, this traffic scene, transportation scene, transition scene, I don't know what we call it, but it's played purely visually, and it's convincing. I buy it.
I did too, because it makes them look more innocent. I mean, they look out of their depth. And also, I'm sure it was probably simpler production-wise, you know. But I think that it works the way it does. I mean, I think that they're quite charming, you know, and they're both perfect specimens of human beings, right? Exquisitely beautiful human beings in their elegant silk clothes in this bronze elevator.
Yeah. With rivets.
With all the industrial rivets, yeah.
It's like riveted, so it's extra hard and cold to me, yeah.
I have to say that the next thing that strikes me as we go along is, of course, the set, and then also music choices, which I did want to mention at the very beginning of the 7 minutes, and I'm sure you've talked about it at other points, but the music that is the violin, the scary violin mm-hmm. music that comes in as Noe approaches the bed. We see his feet approaching the bed. I mean, this is again part of its I don't know, early 60s pop culture aesthetic, where it's so over the top. It's like villain music.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then when we come into Dr. Noe's living space, or, you know, living room, dining room space, the choice of music is or sound effects is so striking to me.
The wind chimes?
Yes. Because I don't know if it's similar or if it's the same exact piece of library music that's used when Betty Davis goes to visit Gail Sundergaard, who's portraying the Eurasian woman who's married to the man that Betty Davis has killed. And this is all in The Letter, the 1940-41 film. Uh-huh. Have you guys mm-hmm. seen that by any chance?
I haven't. Is that William Wellman?
No, this is it's William Wyler.
Wyler. No, it's, I've never seen The Letter.
Okay, so it's set in Malaysia, and Betty Davis is a bored plantation, rubber plantation owner's wife. She has an affair with a British fellow who leaves her for a Eurasian woman. So, of course, this is terrible on multiple counts. And so she lures him to the house, and when he says that he actually loves his wife, then she shoots her lover dead. At any rate, betwixt and between, she later has to go meet the wife to get this incriminating evidence from her. And so when we go into Chinatown, and it's all very scary, and, you know, Betty Davis's eyes are darting about, and when Gail Sundergaard is introduced, it's those same wind chimes.
Wow.
And it's just like, do you people not have more than one piece of library music? You know, first of all, I mean, but it's also the construction of, I know you guys have talked about the yellow face throughout the film and the the construction of Orientalism and Orientalized people. But this piece of music is another part of that construction. And as I say, since I spent way too many hours watching The Letter so many times, it's embarrassing. But yeah, that really jumped out at me. It's like, this is what the sound of the Orient is if you are somebody in Hollywood.
Yeah, there are movements within the score here in these 7 minutes too, not beyond the wind chimes that are kind of playing with the Oriental riff that we all know. You know, I don't even think I have to try to impersonate it or in any way.
Scale, right?
Right. And they're not exactly that, but you even get a little orientalized, if that's the right word, bit as Dr. No is pulling the sheet off of Bond, I think, to give us that little suggestion that, oh, well, we already know about Dr. No. This is obviously Dr. No. But here at the dinner table, when they approach the dinner table, it gets a little bit more, you almost get that pizzicato kind of thing.
Yes, where yes.
Two or three violins are all doing it. It's not exactly that scale exactly, where in earlier Hollywood films you would just get that straight up, right? This is a play on it, but it's doing the same work.
Uh-huh.
I think it's doing the same stereotypical kind of this is what this is telling you, or it's Asian coding or Oriental coding, however you want to put it.
Yes, yes.
You know, and yeah, the wind chimes, you know, I didn't even catch the wind chimes as much as the other stuff. I'm glad you guys pointed those out.
So I guess, I mean, the other things, I mean, everybody talks about the Goya painting of Duke Wellington that was stolen in 1961. And there's also a lot of stuff about the last minute, procurement of the footage for the, aquarium.
Yeah,
I read conflicting things about who's responsible for what. My takeaway is that things could have been planned a little bit better.
Well, you know, that master shot, the first point of view shot where they look at Dr. No's lair, the painting isn't even there.
Oh, that's right. You're absolutely
so
right.
So you can tell, you realize they really did come up with it on the fly, that Ken Adams supposedly painted it overnight.
I've heard multiple accounts.
So one version I got was that the idea came from Joanna Harwood. So I can't figure out if that was in the screenplay or if that was something that she came up with at the last minute and everybody said, yeah. I've also read that actually it was the art department folks who took care of it. It wasn't Ken Adams himself. That it actually they had to blow up postcards to the right size, and then one of the people in the art department then painted it the correct colors overnight, and then they popped it in the frame that was the correct size.
You know, so, that sounds more realistic. The other one sounds too good to be true. The other one sounds like Ken Adams saying, I just whipped this up overnight. I think I'll believe the second one. I like that one better.
Okay.
I have read multiple people say that Joanna Harwood is the one that came up with the idea. And now I don't think it makes sense because her draft of the script was the first, like, kind of rudimentary translation from the book. Just straight up, here's the beats of the book in script forms. And I think that would have wouldn't that have predated that?
Yeah, but I think she,
I
don't think she left the picture. I think she was, wasn't she still working as a...
No, she was a...
So maybe she's hanging around on the set.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nothing I read was specific about that. They were just, it was her idea. And I wasn't able to call exactly where the idea came from or at what point in time. But I do think her draft would have predated the paintings.
Yeah.
Importance and culture.
That's
the theft or whatever.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. I do like it that on the soundtrack that there's this little,
Sting.
Jingle.
Yeah.
That's quite cute.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It doesn't mean anything to anybody today, but boy, I bet it was pretty funny then.
Well, I've read that it really got laughs, particularly in the UK. And it also at that point, that's a moment for Connery. His movement there is much more loose and flexible, and it's a moment where the way he comes up, he pauses and he looks at it, and then he goes up the stairs, which is really, really different from the way Joseph Wiseman is just kind of floated up those stairs. I also, you know, in terms of the performances and then the whole aquarium footage fiasco, I do think it's interesting, from what I can piece together, is that the dialogue had to be adjusted essentially that day. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, because they kept having rollouts on the back projection of the aquarium footage that they had, because they didn't have enough to put it on a loop, and so it was constantly rolling out. So then they could only shoot his parts of conversation in little pieces. That's what I had read or had heard.
So in addition to having to explain the fact that these are big fish, right, so that right. The convex glass, so forth, makes them look bigger. So they had to change their lines, and the way it was shot was also quite disrupted?
Yeah, apparently, because they could only have so many minutes with it running in the background before it ran out. And so they were... So that's I was watching, actually, this time just for that, to see when the fish repeated themselves, you know, and it's pretty good. It's very convincing. And I don't ever feel like I'm seeing the same image again behind anyone.
And the minnows pretending to be whales. I think that's a pretty good line. I think that works. Are you saying I've never heard this? Is that supposedly a part of the dialogue that was added in?
Terrence
to explain
Young apparently
this?
Came up with it. Yeah.
I think that's pretty good.
Yeah, because it would have to be added in, because otherwise it would. I mean, that was all that stuff about the big fish all had to be explained, right? You know, figured out that day.
Because they couldn't find any library footage that was convincing where the fish were the proper size, and so the best looking thing they could get was this aquarium footage, and so that was what they went with.
Because again, they're looking at the last minute. And I production's so crazy. I don't know why it was, you know, last minute. It seems like, you know.
Peter Hunt says that nobody told him until he saw the set built. He's like, what's that big open space? And they're like, well, that's where the fish are going to be. And he goes, well, it's a good thing that somebody maybe should tell me, because I got to go find the plates for that.
Right. That's what I read, too. And this is like a day before they're supposed to start shooting.
Yeah. Fast and Furious.
Well, I have a question about the cinematography here, and then we can get into Joseph Wiseman maybe and his performance a little bit as well with this. But we get a close-up of Dr. No coming in, and the point I want to make about this close-up is he's pretty bright-eyed. Like, you can see his eyes very well in the way that the scene is lit. But when he walks through the lair and we see him from a wider shot, I think his eyes are distinctly... like shark-like. And I don't know if that's intentional or a byproduct of the way the scene was shot. He's just very dead-eyed throughout that. And I remember noticing that. Did you either of you notice that as well?
Now that
you
mention
it,
yeah.
You just can't see his eyes at all. They're black. And I think that's an interesting way to light a character in a shot. And specifically while they're talking about fish and so on, anyway.
In the book, he's got black contact lenses that cover his entire eyes. He even taps it with his knife, kind of like old Bill in Gangs of New York.
That's right.
And so maybe that was a choice by the cinematographer to try to find a way to light him, to give him, you know, more dead eyes. I don't know. Or maybe it's the he's wearing, obviously, applications to try to stretch his eyes, you know, a little bit.
So... yeah, that was the other thing I wanted to bring up, because there's something about Wiseman's performance, his physicality, that it works really well for me. So this isn't at all a criticism, but I do wonder if he's struggling a little bit beneath those appliances, because sometimes his movement, it looks as though he's struggling a little bit. But at the same time, it gives the character this robotic, creepy element that works really well. So I don't know if one... helps, if that helped him a little bit with the performance, or if it was part of the decision he made. I can't move, I can't blink my eyes, I can't act with my eyes very well here, so my physicality has to be more profound. I don't know. I was wondering if either of you had any takes on that, or his performance in general in these minutes.
I think you make a really good point that potentially that this restriction on his eyes, where he can't move them, you know, he can't use his eyebrows or, you know, look side to side or anything like that. I think my sense is that he went with it. And one of the things that strikes me is the fact that he doesn't move a muscle in his face to his word. He doesn't even use the muscles in his mouth practically the words just seem to kind of flow out of him. It makes him even more creepy. And it's a real counterpoint to Connery, who's moving and his eyebrows are going up and down and his eyes are, you know, looking side to side, and they just couldn't be more different. And they've also got Joseph Wiseman's hair slicked back. I mean, that must hurt to have your hair slicked back like that. So I do, I think that it all, however it came to be, I think that it works quite nicely in the sort of robotic result that occurs.
You make a good point about the juxtaposition of Connery and Wiseman's performances as well. Specifically, they're both smoking during the dinner scene, and they both hold their cigarettes distinctly different as well. You have Wiseman's got this very, well, he's got a fake hand, so that's a big part of why he's holding it so stiffly, but he's very rigid, upright. His shoulders are like kind of high, a little higher maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And Connery is very casual in that seat, even though he's sitting. It's not like he has bad posture. He's not kicking up a knee or anything, but he looks very relaxed. And the way Connery smokes a cigarette, of course, is iconically cool. Where Wiseman looks a little closer to like some like a Hitchcock villain, like a North by Northwest, the way the guy holds it by the point, by the filter or whatever. It's so, I'd say the juxtaposition is there. And I think he's playing to his strengths and his limitations for sure.
Well, limitations being in, you mean with having no hands
with the appliances
and not being able to move his eyes?
Right. Yeah.
Right. And having to pretend. Yeah. Acting like you don't have hands. That's interesting. I wonder how you make that approach as an actor. Like, well, you obviously have hands. Now pretend like you don't have hands. You know, it's interesting. It's pantomime, I suppose. Like the training in a field like that probably helps a lot with that. But
well,
he does a great job.
Probably what he does is that he shrunk where his center of energy is. And right. So that's how everything gets much more bound as opposed to free flowing. And it's also how he, everything is very precise and thought out. And so he can't just suddenly reach for something. That's not part of who he is. But he's also, as the character, this character is outsmarted pretty much everybody, and also has been shunned by everyone. So he has really withdrawn into himself. And I think that really comes through in the performance.
You know, it's so interesting to try to figure out what Dr. No wants. Is James Bond wondering that too? Like, why are we at a dinner table? Why hasn't he killed us by now? I mean, he finally does. We get around to it. But there's a strange suspense that's created by just the weirdness of it. This is not what you're, I guess would maybe Fu Manchu would have Nolan Smith sitting at the table with him, since we were kind of in Fu Manchu territory anyway.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But, and then it becomes a job interview. So it's like the agenda of Dr. No is mysterious and it is like, his physicality makes it even weirder. Like,
absolutely.
What's he going to do? He's barely moving.
Partly one of the things that really came clear to me, or at least struck me, I don't know if it's clear, but that particularly if you start from the lifting up the sheet to the middle of the conversation where this 7 minutes stops, you know, he's told Bond to, you know, put the knife back. And then he says, I'm disappointed. And so basically, to your point, Mitch, I think that what is going on is that this is, it's both a job interview and also, to me, this is sort of Dr. No's way of wooing Bond. This is a love scene. This is actually a failed seduction scene. And what's happened is that in Dr. No's mind, Bond has failed. He's ended up as just this clumsy guy who can't see the bigger picture.
Yeah,
I love this seduction thing because it makes me think of that Mike Nichols. Everything should be a negotiation, a seduction, or a fight. And we kind of get all three in this. We get some seduction. We do get a little bit of negotiation in the failed job interview, and we do get a bit of a fight. So you get all three. You got the Mike Nichols quadfecta in this scene.
Well, yeah. Trifecta. And I think that's why it's so fun. I just think it's a really fun scene. And then, if you think about the times where we do, at the dinner table, where we do cut to Ursula Andress, there's really only these two important times in the first part of the scene, first part of the scene at the dining room table. And the first one is about the hands again. And it's the second time that the hands have come up. And both times, she just looks absolutely disgusted by him not having hands. And that had been something that had gone on over by the aquarium window. And so she's like, you don't have hands. I mean, you can make the joke. I mean, he not only has, like small hands, large hands, no hands.
Yeah.
He has no hands, which to her is disgusting. And then the second time that we cut to her, it's when Dr. No says, you're the only man who I thought would be able to understand and appreciate what I'm doing here. The one man I've met who's capable of appreciating what I've done. And we cut to Ursula Andress, and she's like, oh my God, what is this? Is this a declaration of love? And it just keeps going. But I think there's a camp reading in here. And I usually don't go down this path. This is not what I do for my, with my spare time, but or for my job. But I just, there's something that made it more fun. And it made it make more sense that that Dr. No is genuinely disappointed. He's very isolated. He talks about how he's isolated. The West turns him down. The East turns him down. They don't get it.
You get me. We have it again in Skyfall, right? There are these occasionally these relationships with these villains where they seem to be very, very interested in James Bond.
Yeah. And then James is just too prosaic. I mean, he's just too straight. He's too willing to be the stupid policeman, He just keeps wanting to fight back. And I think it's just, it cracks me up because I think there's something really, I don't know, almost uncomfortable for Connery to portray that Connery's, again, okay, I'm speculating wildly. This may need to be edited out.
We have a very accomplished camp director coming up next. So this sort of perfectly sets the stage for him.
Okay.
On the next.
Well, it's just that I think that, you've talked with other folks about the fact that, Connery's been very deferential, for example, when he interacts with Bernard Lee in his role as M. And then at the end of that tussle, well, it's actually a tussle about the guns.
Mm-hmm.
One of you folks who was talking about how petulant Connery seemed. Was that you, John?
Well, I was talking about that. I think we were Jason Heck, who was our guest on that week. We were all talking about it. I think it was very, very on the surface. He might have been the one to use the word petulant. I don't remember. But yeah, we were talking about that.
I mean, you also talked about, in talking about the, different actors portraying Bond. My sense is that Connery was less comfortable playing the dutiful errand boy of the Empire.
I think that's really interesting. And I didn't realize until I read somewhere that the supposed Scottish heritage of James Bond was only added in Mammoth the Golden Gun well after Connery had gotten into the good graces of Ian Fleming, and Fleming had approved of Connery as the actor. And so therefore, suddenly he writes into the backstory that James Bond is Scottish. So I think you're right. I think that the fact that he's not straight up English gives him an anti-hero, a kind of rebellious bully boy. Maybe he's even, you know, there's an angry young man somewhere inside of this particular James Bond.
Right.
I think that's all really valid.
And to speak to directly to Connery's choices, he's got since he was James Bond, he has a track record politically of fighting for Scottish independence, right? I mean, he had it in him the whole way. So I like your take that maybe he wasn't into the idea of being the errand boy for the Empire. He's definitely not into it in real life. So good reading.
At any rate, I think that it comes through in the repartee at the dining room table, because I think it feels like he's almost forcing himself to have these comebacks that are batted away by Dr. No, and I it's really clear that to me anyway, that as much as Bond fights in this gentlemanly arena, that Dr. No wins. And it's really only when they get to the end of the film and he can kind of rough and tumble it, does he actually best the villain. And I just find this all really interesting.
Yeah, I think that's great. That makes total sense. Well, he's not even that impressed when he crushes the Buddha with his iron hands. I mean, I think Bond is probably thinking, well, I could still beat you up, but you're not letting me beat you up right now. You're making me sit here and talk to you over the dinner table.
Right. This is not where this is not his area of expertise. This is not his strength. He's really pinned in there, which is why it's kind of fun. I mean, I think that it's nice that there's been this marvelous buildup to Dr. No all the way through. And then, we finally, 87 minutes in, we finally meet Dr. No. And then to have Dr. No / Joseph Wiseman basically control and drive the scene is pretty fun.
It is, and it's a welcome dynamic, right? Because Bond is he's pretty much won all the way through up to this point. So
yes.
It's kind of nice to see him start losing for a while so that he can win in the end.
Exactly, right. And so he goes, moves into the third act where it's, he's in the really narrow passageway that takes him into the final control room where the big battle is set. And, this is end of the sort of tough end of act two. Do you guys read it that way?
I mean, I pretty much think Dr. No appears at the beginning of the third act. That's probably where I'd mark it. But yeah, I think that's it. We're either at the end of the second act or we've moved into the third.
Yeah. Okay.
I wanted to talk just for a minute about how, in your essay, you write a lot about how James Bond in the books was this kind of way for England to be rehabilitated, or the tarnished British Empire to be shined up with this hero who is, representative of this fading empire, but he's still kind of this winner and this competent guy. So he's still very much. So I guess my question is, is the James Bond of the movies the Englishman of the James Bond of the books, or is he representing England in the same way that the books do in the movies, or is he an international hero, or is he American? I mean, I'm always this part of is Dr. No a British film or an American film?
Oh, let's go there. Okay, I have I was reading something recently about how the Bond franchise is a wonderful particularly at the beginning, a wonderful combination of British talent and American marketing expertise.
Right. Yeah.
And so I mean, if you think about this moment of, you know, in the 60s, where London is the center of the popular cultural world, you've got the U.S. Certainly looking to the mother country to know what to do. You've got also all of these films that are being shot, all these Hollywood films that are being shot throughout Europe and throughout the globe during this period of time of runaway production in the post-war period, and particularly late 50s, early 60s. Late 60s, it starts to get too expensive. But I think that it's the new American empire trying to emulate what was valuable about the old one, and about the British Empire, and give it a little bit of an update with its I don't know if you would say like Hugh Hefner twist.
Mm-hmm.
Since that's sort of the, you know, America's contribution to popular culture in the 1950s is the beginning of Playboy magazine.
Playboy meets swinging London altogether.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. So I don't know that I can really, you know, I mean, do you guys have thoughts on whether Dr. No is a British film or an American film or both?
I mean, I always think of it as a British film. It's a British production, like you said, with British talent. But it certainly is playing by America's rules, right? As far as distribution and release and censorship, even, I think. I mean, they're thinking about the Hollywood censorship, not so much the censorship boards of Britain at the time, I think. It seems to be a Hollywood film that happens to be made by Brits. That's just my impression. I'm not sure how accurate it is.
Expatriate American producers who've been producing movies in England
that
for
too.
The last decade.
It's just the Bond movies never, I mean, they could be so British, like, you know, skiing off the cliff or whatever with the British parachute and, you know, the Union Jack parachute and things. It's this like go Britain, like patriotism. At the same time, I never feel like it's they're British productions. I always think of them as being, they're in the mix with American films. 100%, sometimes even dominating American films at the box office and playing by those rules. And back in the early 60s, that was much more of a thing, right? The British film industry and the American film industry at the time were much more separate than they are now, right?
I
mean, is that an accurate thing to say?
No. Early 60s, no? Everything is completely bound together.
Really?
Because
I always think of the 50s, I'm watching movies in the 50s. When I watch British films, like, you get that certificate at the front. You get the British censorship board certificates, and I'm thinking, well, that has no regard for American censorship
in terms of the different seals. But the period of the late 50s all the way through the early 60s and into the late 60s is a period of intense international co-production,
right?
All ushered in by my buddy Lou Wasserman, particularly once you have the studios functioning primarily as financiers and not as production companies. And you have all of the above-the-line talent having their own, not being employees and having their own corporations. Everybody wants to shoot internationally. And it's cheaper. I mean, you guys have talked a lot about how inexpensive, how little money was spent on this film. I mean, this is pretty typical. They would, you know, you'd be able to get really high value talent and really high value, production, quality in general, for very little money, because everybody wanted to sort of play in Hollywood during this period of time. I mean, if you think about something like Lolita, which came out in 1962. So you've got, you know, Stanley Kubrick, who's moved to the UK to work. You've got Peter Sellers as, you know, a central figure. And is Lolita a British film or an American film? You know, it has Shelley Winters. Does that make it American? I don't know. There's just a lot of international production at this time. So I think it really fits into that larger picture.
Yeah. I wonder sometimes whether if Dr. No had been made 3 years earlier or 3 years later, whether it would have had the same impact. There seems to be something that's just absolutely perfect about when it gets made, you know, just in terms of what was being happening with physical production and distribution and where the censors were at the time. And it's just kind of amazing that it seemed to fall in the exact right place in the right time.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, one of the things a lot of people talk about, the fact that 1965 is really a division between old Hollywood and new Hollywood. People also talk about 1964 being the beginning of the 60s. So if Dr. No, in its particular visualization, had come out in 65, I think it would have seemed really odd. Mm-hmm. But it was just racy enough for 1962, 1963.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I do think we need to kind of keep in mind that there's a fair amount of, suggestion going on in the late 50s, early 60s, which would let something like Dr. No fit right in. And I don't think that people would be scandalized at all. At least some, you know, at least the people who were wanting to be part of the jet set. I mean, you got to think about, I mean, this is the counterculture is actually happening, you know, a certain type of counterculture is happening late 50s, early 60s. And it's not just beatniks.
Right. Yeah.
And I just, you know, if you think about things like the pill becoming available in 1960, you know, the Kinsey reports in 48, 53. I mean, there's a fair amount going on.
Yeah, and that explains, too, why the Bond films are there. Usually Bond only has one girl, one woman in the books, but suddenly this James Bond with multiple lovers, it's pretty much a trope now, starting with Dr. No, and it's going to continue all the way through, and that has to do with the pill and with the changes in sexual mores at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to ask, Dave, we're talking about the 60s. When you were talking about Ursula Andress's introduction coming out of the water, did you talk about the photographer, Bunny Yeager, who came to the set to do publicity stills?
Yeah, Joe Dader brought her up for a moment, but we didn't get into it too far, I don't think.
I saw that she was invited to come and photograph the new starlet. And Yeager was described as the person who had made Betty Page famous. It's actually Bunny Yeager's photographs of Betty Page that led to Betty Page being the Miss January in 1955. So I just thought it was really quite fascinating that Bunny Yeager in particular is brought in to do the glamour photography of the new starlet. And so there's a kind of system that's already been worked out by the time you get to 1962 that combines this sort of way of presenting rising starlets at this period of time. And this really caught my attention because Kubrick's first film, Fear and Desire, which came out in 53, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's a very, existential allegory about war and death and soldiers going through hell and blah, blah, blah. But it also has this girl in it who's then, with photography by Kubrick himself, becomes the selling point in all the posters and so forth. And so there's this kind of weird, you know, artistic photography slash exploitation slash popular culture that links all these sort of promotions of young women in the American movie business or popular culture movie business at this time, which is just, it's just fascinating.
So pinup culture just ties right in with all of the, with James Bond again at this time. It's all like this perfect storm of things that are happening or in and
it
around
really
Dr.
is.
No.
And I think they were astute enough to be able to really cash in on all that. And I give him a lot of credit. I think it's pretty amazing.
Well, that's a perfect note to end on, unless you have any other final thoughts about these minutes.
No, I really appreciate chatting with you, and I appreciate you prompting me to go back and think about the film again. And also, thanks for all your other podcasts. I really enjoyed them.
Oh, we're really, really glad to have you on the show. And I don't know when we're going to get to From Russia with Love, but you have a standing invitation if you'd like to come back and opine on that. Well, you can work through the movies with us and save yourself the extra work.
Well, thank you.
All right, that's going to do it for 007x7 this week. Make sure to come over to our Patreon page at patreon.com/alienminute. to check out some of our supplemental material. We also have a TeePublic page. We got lots of designs from Alien Minute, and even our very unique 007x7 logo. If you want to come over and get that on a t-shirt or a mug, we'd love for you to do that. So that's going to do it for this week. We'll see you next week. Thanks.